Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, continuing the reading of my 2015 novel, Bust It Like a Mule, The Tale of Cotton King Fisher. Chapter 17. On Friday nights over the summer, the men on at the park head to Stumptown for some drinks and maybe a fight and maybe to see a girl, which is what they were doing when Cotton caught them in the dog leg that day, when Cotton first wandered into town. But Cotton has been staying away from trouble, so he does not go into town so much now, but stays in the cabin smoking and drinking and playing cards with Jacob Two Calves. But this particular Friday night, Cotton can't seem to shake being drug into town like that bull drug him the once, and by God, he does not think he might see that pretty as a glacial plain with elk roaming on it jail girl. But he can't help himself. He's just a man, damn it, and a Cotton King Fisher man at that. Jacob Two Calves goes back to the res to see his family, but before he goes, he says, "Don't get into trouble." And Cotton says, "I am trouble," and laughs. And Jacob knows this, but he has become real fond of his buck wild white friend, and he would not wish any harm to come to him, so he tells him just the same. Cotton gets to town and tries to do the right thing by avoiding rough places, though for the life of him he cannot remember why, and he wonders where his bull balls have gone. But he don't care all that much, truth be told, for he is happy in the land where the world began. So he heads over to the Grange for what he heard was a social from his boss man, Fred Mason. Cotton figures Mason is trying to keep him out of trouble, and he likes him for it, even though he is a goddamn Yankee. They are both fond of another apiece for some reason. Cotton would say the reason why is that Fred Mason is a good boss and appreciates a hard worker. And Fred Mason would say that it is because Cotton is one of the hardest working men he has ever seen. But it is more than that, and they both know it, though neither says it. It is just there. That is the way men are sometimes, by God. I have seen it. They just like one another, and some men have a way of pulling another man to them, like Cotton to Mason and the other way around. It is a sight to see when you see it, a fisher of men like Cotton, and I will be damned if this didn't happen to him often. The men that he didn't beat gathered around like he was a hobo Jesus dealing out victuals on the mount. Mason did not gather around Cotton for victuals, but he respected him just the same as if they'd been in war together. And what Cotton did not know is that those men in Oregon not only told Mason about how he saved a man's life in the Tillamook Burn, but that he also saved a bunch of goddamn men in the war. Don't ask me how they know this, because Cotton don't talk about that. So I should just hush up. That is his story to tell, damn it. I only told it for to tell you what Mason heard. Mason was with his wife when Cotton got there to the Grange social, and she was one of the prettiest women Cotton has ever seen, with fire engine red hair and poofy skirted flower dress, like she was a flower her damn self. And she had the manners of an East Coaster, but none of the bitch, and Cotton dug her, like the old Negroes say, right away. "I have heard all about you, Cotton," she says, and Cotton says, "Well, I guess I best be leaving then." And she and Mason laugh, and Mason clapped him on the back like, "See, I told you this guy is something else." And Cotton felt warm all over because of it. And the Mason kids, there are three of them, one girl and two boys, look up at Cotton like he is the toughest gosh darn man they have ever seen, with the scars on his arms under his t-shirt he is wearing, because it is a mite warm. And he smiles and winks at them, and they smile back like he is a friendly bear. Cotton feels underdressed in but his white t-shirt and new work boots with a white sole and red hide sewn like moccasins for white men for climbing and digging that he bought with his first government paycheck under his rolled-up work pants, for he realizes it ain't just a social, it is a god-dang square dance party. He tells Mason he should have warned him about it being a dance party, and Mason says, "You wouldn't have come if I did." And Cotton has to give him this, and also that Mason is a sly dog. There is a lantern-lit floor laid out behind the Grange and a whole mess of townsfolk, all who Cotton's reputation has proceeded to, and all who cannot believe he is there, and with Mason to boot, by God. So Cotton swaggers in like he owns a damn Grange just to show the townsfolk it ain't no skin off his nose, and that he is proud to be with Mason. Being that this is a family gathering, there ain't much to drink but beer and coolers men bring. So Mason shares his beer cans with Cotton, and Cotton watches Mason and his wife dance and laugh with the children, and he sees those mountains rising up behind them like it is the Mason family's wallpaper. And Cotton feels a queer feeling in his bones that he wishes he did not. He never saw his mama and daddy dance and laugh like that, and he feels mighty sad about right then, and he wonders why old man made some men and women from the same good earth and some men and women from the same bad earth. He is standing back guzzling a beer and watching the dancers and hearing the callers' calls echo off the mountain walls, just feeling sad about how his mama and daddy never danced and never laughed, when Mrs. Mason, Elsa is her name, makes Cotton dance with her, and the townsfolk are all damned to hell when they see him do all the steps and twirl Mrs. Mason as if he is a goddamn champion square dancer, and he might be, for I have heard some rumors, but I cannot prove them, of his dancing days in the Dakotas. Mason and his wife clap when it is all done, and then they all sit at a table and eat cold fried chicken Mrs. Mason made up, and homemade bread with butter and fruits and berries and beer and cola. And the summer night is starting to cool, and the light is going Flathead Lake blue above the Swan and Rocky Mountains. "Where did you learn to dance like that?" Elsa Mason asks him, and Cotton says, "I was dancing when I came out of the womb." And the Mason children giggle, and one of the boys, the younger one, I think, says, "Where did you get those scars?" pointing to Cotton's bare forearms, and Mrs. Mason shushes her son and tells him it is not polite to say such things, but Cotton says, "The boy is all right, ma'am. I earned 'em, every last one of 'em, son. I'll tell you how when you get older." And the Mason boy looks at his daddy, Fred Mason, and his daddy nods at him like it would be all right for Cotton to tell him about how he earned them scars, every last one of 'em, when the boy is old enough. Cotton remembers how his daddy had scars written upon his flesh, but he never told Cotton how he earned 'em. He just let loose their stories by beating them into his son, and Cotton would not wish that on any little boy. Cotton is off by a pine tree alone, smoking later in the night, when who should he see but that goddamn beautiful jail girl walk into the lights from the lanterns of the dance floor under the big sky, and Cotton's gut heart does an ass over tea kettle so that he coughs on cigarette smoke going down the wrong goozle, as his daddy used to say. For he was thinking of the girl and not his smoke, and she looks over to the coffin and sees him outside of the ring of light and smiles and waves at him. She's got a poofy skirt dancing dress like Mrs. Mason, and her hair pulled back and red, red lips like the color of them New Mexico Blood of Christ mountains when the sun is going down that Cotton has not seen for years and years. Cotton don't know if he wants to go into the ring of light as that yonder woman is waving him on in, but he is a hell of a dancer and she is a hell of a girl, so he goes back in. "What are you doing here?" she asks him nice-like, like she is glad he is there, just surprised. And he says, "Came with the Mason family." And she says, "Oh, getting all domesticated, huh?" And before he can answer, Mason comes up and says, "Hello, jail. Cotton, remember no trouble, you hear?" And Cotton says, "I don't aim to." "Oh, don't worry," Jail says. "Dad isn't here, and neither is Terry. I saw Cotton in the bar that day he beat Terry. Terry was asking for it, Mr. Mason." "Oh, I know he was. Cotton here is one of my best men, and I couldn't afford to lose him over some trouble about a local thing, you know." "No problems here," Jail says. "No problems here," Cotton says. Then they are off dancing to a lively tune with Mr. Mason just watching and worrying a touch, for he is a wise man that knows about love and knows about trouble, and he respects Cotton Kingfisher enough to know that the man is capable of both in spades. Chapter 18. If you have never seen a do-si-do or a chicken in the bread pan kicking out dough, or I'll amend your partner, or promenade, or a two-step, then you are missing out. But if you have seen them and haven't seen them done by Cotton, then you are further missing out. And lastly of all, if you have seen either of these things, but not with that beer bottle wildflower pretty girl that night under the Montana big sky, my friend, you missed a show. Cotton was dancing to beat the band, and JL was not to be outdone, by God. And they were stepping and kicking and hooting and hollering and laughing. And by God, the townsfolks even got into the show and had to admit the Drifter was the best damn dancer they had ever seen. JL's cheeks were flushed like she was a little girl playing kick the can. And Cotton's big sky sun dark skin was shimmering from busting it like a mule on the dance floor. And even though the sun was down, Cotton thought of old man smiling down on him. Between dances, JL would sip some punch and pretend to talk to the old ladies or Mrs. Mason while looking at Cotton's fighting, crooked profile, handsome face above them ladies' heads. And Cotton would pretend to talk to Fred Mason and the Mason boys, but he was watching JL the whole time, and both of them knew it, and both of them liked it, by God. At one point, I will be goddamned if Cotton did not pick up a banjo. And stiff like at first, but better the more oiled up he got, bust out an old railroad tune while the old man whose banjo it was clapped him on. Besides that, he called two songs for the dancers, and he'd call like this. First couple to the right, change and swing, and Mr. Peabody, put that punch down. Now that's enough, now you hear. Change and swing, now you're home, and everybody swing. Interrupting the dance to call out Mr. Peabody, the old banjo man who was drinking punch at the back, and everyone would laugh, even Mr. Peabody. JL danced with Mr. Mason and looked up at the rowdy cuss Oaky calling from on top of a chair with his accent roaring back, though he was not mad at all, and she smiled when he winked down at her while she twirled her dress like the wildflowers blooming on the great plains. When the night was wearing thin and the square dance caller was hoarse and the Mason kids were asleep on picnic tables, Cotton helped put tables and chairs and children away, and some of the elder townsfolk can't remember what they heard about him being such a bad man, because they sure had a hell of a time with him tonight, and you and I both know this is just the way that man can be. Cotton saw the Masons off with JL standing at his side, and Mason parted with, "No bruises, bumps, or scratches on Monday morning, Kingfisher." And Cotton says, "Scout's honor." And Mrs. Mason smiles at him and JL like she knows something they don't. Then the ornery mean cuss that is oxbow strong and mule kick tough square dance champ and the big sky, big sun, maid of the mountains girl are standing alone in the dark for a piece, and the stars are shining down on them like Christmas lights Cotton has only ever seen from the outside looking in. "I can't remember the last time I had that much fun," JL says as they lean against his truck and smoke his hand-rolled cigarettes. "Me either," Cotton says, and he means it, by God. "See, you aren't all trouble." Cotton grunts and says, "I heard about you and that Terry kid before I rolled on into town." For Cotton has never been one to beat about the bush, even if it is a fiery, by God, bush. He figures to just get it out of the way. Why waste the time, by God? That's just the way he is. And JL is quiet for a minute, smoking after he says this. Then she goes, "Yes, we were an item." Like they were two cans of beans setting together on the shelf of the grocery store here in town, not lovers. And this makes Cotton feel a mite better. "Is that why I haven't seen you?" she asks. "Maybe. Or maybe I'm just trying to stay out of by God trouble." "Am I trouble?" the girl asks, and Cotton hears her batting her lashes in the dark. "If you are with Terry, you sure as hell are, and your daddy sure as hell don't like me none." And he blows out some smoke, then goes on, "Sides, goddamn pretty girls are always trouble." And he couples the curse to the compliment to make it not seem so goddamn big. Even though you shouldn't curse in front of a lady, but neither should you call her pretty unless you are ready for trouble, so he did both at once. Cotton can't see in the dark, but JL blushes red, and not by his cursing, which she never minds, and she smiles, then says, "I am not with Terry anymore, and I apologize about my dad. He wanted me and Terry to be something that we aren't. I think he has it out for you because he likes Terry, and he is mad at me for not marrying him." "Why's that? You not marrying and all?" Cotton asks, and JL shrugs. "It was years ago that Terry and I were an item, before he went to the Navy. Then he went away for a few years and came back, and I was over it, but he thought I was still his sweetheart. He isn't the nicest guy, and I guess I got sick of him bossing me around. He's a bully, and he's been mad ever since I refused him, and I guess so has my dad. What's your mama say about all this? My mom left my dad a long time ago when I was just a baby. She left to go be a star in California. I don't even know what she looks like. Dad doesn't treat me all that well because of it, though he'd never say that. I don't think he likes women too much after Mom left. He just wants to marry me off and get me out of the house. Damn, that is rough, sister. I'm used to it. Your mama must have been real pretty, Cotton says. Why's that? Because I know you didn't get your looks from your daddy. And J.L. likes the compliment very much, for it sounds like an old familiar country and western song, especially coming out all rough and smoky oaky-like from Cotton. You're too much, Cotton, she says, and Cotton feels all light as a robin's feather when she says his name familiar-like, like they're a man and wife at breakfast. So Mason thinks you're going to get into trouble, J.L. asks him. Yep, he thinks I need to steer clear of just about everyone. I don't blame him, I suppose. He saw Terry after I beat him raw. More than anything, Mason don't want me to fail, I think. Well, that's kind of him. It sure is now, ain't it? I don't know if anyone has been kinder to old Cotton than Mason, Cotton says, and he thinks on this for a bit as he smokes with the girl beside him brushing up against his hot skin like the cool mountain wind. Chapter 19. Now just when the conversation is settling in like the smoke from the cigarettes, the couple is shined upon by a pair of headlights and a car stops and the doors swing open and someone gets out and hollers, Cotton Kingfisher, we want to have a word with you. And Cotton don't recognize the voice nor the dark figure that owns it, but there are five others or more besides, illuminated in the car headlights like they've been drinking muddy water, for Cotton can't make none of them out. Y'all come back for another ass-whoopin', Cotton hollers, and J.L. looks very scared, but Cotton just laughs. Get away from the girl, the voice says. We know what your intentions are. And when the stranger says this, he gives Cotton a sudden notion that they aim to harm J.L. and blame it on the drifter being him. So Cotton says real quick, get in the truck and lock it. Then he shoves J.L. into the truck cab as someone comes at him from the dark, swinging a goddamn baseball bat whooshing through the air, but Cotton dodges it, and it busts the truck with a sound like a shell off a tank turret, and Cotton picks up whoever swung that goddamn bat bodily by the throat and groin and heaves him up and over the truck clean to the other side, and Cotton hears whoever it is screaming as he is sailing through the air. Another jackass tries to reach the truck door where JL is hiding, but she slams the lock, and Cotton sees red, though it is black outside, and drives his fist so hard through the man's face going for the door that it breaks that man's jaw with a crack-like snap, and the man just slobbers and slumps, and the fight is over for him as he drops like a bag of by-God flour to the dust. But Cotton catches a bat hard clean across his bat, and he is mad now. Ooh, boy, watch out. He turns quick as a bighorn sheep on Grinnell Glacier and headbutts the bat bearer in the throat as he catches another bat hard across his ribs as the man he headbutts falls back like a mover's dolly stacked with boxes back down some stairs. And Cotton gets hit again with a damn bat, and he can't quite see who is all where, but what he can do is grab the bat as it whistles in at him, and he does exactly that. He catches a blow in his callous mitt palm and with wrench wrist strength yanks the bat out of one of the hands of those bastards. And as another comes in on him, he blocks it with his own procured timber, throws off the blow, then brings his bat up and cleaves back down like he is bringing an axe down on Oregon timber. And it drops someone right quick, no cry or nothing. He hit the poor SOB so hard. Someone on the passenger side of the truck hits JL's window hard and it breaks in on her as she screams, and Cotton blocks a home run hit and runs, leaps into the back of the truck and out to the other side with a goddamn Brer Rabbit bound, and as he flies through the air, he slashes his bat down on the window breaker so hard that he breaks the man's bat as he tries to protect himself with it, and Cotton's bat keeps on going and breaks the man's shoulder from his chest cage as well as his bat, and the man is out of the fight hollering and crying in the dirt. There is a scurry from the attackers as the car roars to life and starts to drive on off into the night, and some of the men are left and start chasing after it, shouting. And Cotton chases after them, and JL from the lock truck has never seen a man so fast as this. He chases down one man and clobbers him from behind, still has time to go after another, and this man is in trouble, for Cotton is so mad he hits him several times with a bat. Then get this. He takes this man over his shoulder and throws him up into a tree, by God, I swear, and I will be damned if that man does not stick up in there. Only then is Cotton done. A few others manage to get away, so Cotton is angry as all hell, and he does not even care that he won, as he hears nothing but the blood in his ears pounding like a damn blood war drum. From the truck, JL can see his crooked fighting profile in the headlights of the truck, and his white shirt gleaming white with specks of blood here and there on it, and he is just standing there, his chest heaving up and down in the swirling dust, with his arms clenched like pine boughs. She stays in the truck, not unlocking the doors, and she wonders why these men hate this man so much, and what is going on in Stumptown, and by God, this man is one hell of a brawler. She sees Cotton light up a cigarette and start to smoke, and though she is a little scared of him, she wishes he would get back on in the truck with her. What she does not know, and it is probably better that she don't, is that Cotton is waiting for the blood rush to calm down, for he feels like he could kill someone if he ain't careful. It wouldn't be the first time, by God, but it would be the first time he has let the blood rush go away without trying to squeeze it out like a tube of toothpaste, so he lets it. By the time he heads back to the truck and clambers in, he has finished a smoke and started another, and he asks JL, "You all right, girl?" And she says, "Yes, my God, are you?" And he says, "Uh-huh." Then starts the truck and drives off, leaving the clobbered men just laying around in the dust near the Grange, and one of them is still hanging up in a tree like a bar brawl crucifix. "They must want me out bad if they'd harm you," Cotton says on the way back to JL's house. "They weren't going to harm me," she says. "They just wanted to scare me." "Honey, them boys ain't messing around. They want me out of town, and they were going to do something to you and pin it on me. I heard it." Cotton drives JL to her daddy's house, who is not there, and she says, "Come on in and I'll see to you," pointing to the welts forming on him from the bat blows he took. And he says, "Sugar, I ain't going to get arrested by your daddy for being violent." And JL says, "You didn't do anything but in self-defense, damn it." And Cotton says, "You think that matters, 'cause it don't. And sides, I'm fine." And JL gets all mad that he is acting like it ain't nothing when it is something. And he don't have to act so damn tough in front of her. She saw how hard he got hit. So she hollers, "Cotton Kingfisher, you shut your mouth and get inside so I can see to you right this minute." And no girl talks to Cotton Kingfisher like that, by God, but she just did. So Cotton yes ma'ams and goes on into the house and lets her see to him, by God. He takes his bloody t-shirt off and sits on the edge of the bathtub in the bathroom of an old house in Stumptown with yellow painted walls and pictures of birds and some paintings of landscapes and such. JL runs some water and gives him ice cubes wrapped in kitchen towels and uses witch hazel on the welts and bruises now running fresh stories over his calloused hide. He does not wince once as she sees to him, just smokes, and she thinks he is the toughest by God man she has ever seen, and she respects him for it as only a woman could, for men see Cotton as an ornery cuss, but being she is a woman, she is able to see him as a brave man who has seen too much to tell by letting on by wincing at a little old thing like witch hazel. He sits there and smokes while JL soaks his bruisings, and he looks at a painted picture of going to the Sun Mountain with the sunset behind it, like you'd climbed the ladder and found the sun, and now the sun could say goodbye. "There's a pretty picture," he says as he looks at it, and JL says, "Thanks." "Did you do it?" Cotton asks, and he turns to the girl nursing on him. "Yes." "You paint?" "Damn, sister, that is all right. I see that mountain every day, and you really nailed it." "Thanks, Cotton." And he likes the way she says his name all familiar-like, like they're a married couple getting ready for to go to bed together. "I'd no idea you were an artist." "Yeah, I dabble. I like to paint and draw. Landscapes, mostly. I also do some pottery. No kidding? That's real fine, JL, real fine. And JL likes the way he says her name instead of calling her girl and honey and sugar and missy, like he is her husband and she is patching him up from a hard day working the big, raw-boned earth. That's all for tonight. You've been hearing my novel, Bust It Like a Mule. I'm Caleb Mannon, and have a heap of help from Mike Ailman and Vern Windham, who recorded and edited it. It is a production of Spokane Public Radio for The Bookshelf. Bust It Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course. Oh, and the author's front porch. For original music and more about the book, visit CalebMannon.com. Catch you next time. If you've missed any of the episodes, head over to kpbx.org to hear the podcast.